You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
When union workers bargain with an employer, the strike is often seen as the last resort and the only effective recourse sometimes in asserting collective power. And this power is undermined for sure when governments legislate back to work union members from their picket lines or preemptively legislate obstacles to unions' capability to fall back on the threat of job action. Newfoundland and Labrador has a unique tradition of effectively countering such government interventions, and joining me to discuss some lessons learned from that tradition is Hans Rollman. Hans is an activist as well as a reporter and a columnist, and he edits a Newfoundland-based site called theindependent.ca. He wrote on this topic in the November-December issue of Briar Patch magazine, and we've reached him this morning in Toronto. Good morning, Hans, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Hi.
We hear about unions being legislated back to work with increasing frequency in Canada, but how does Canada compare globally in terms of this kind of government action?
Well, Canada compares extremely badly. We are one of the our governments, I should say, because it occurs at both the federal and provincial level. But our governments are among the worst perpetrators of legislating or curtailing workers' collective bargaining rights, and that means both intervening in collective bargaining processes or overruling collective agreements or legislating workers back to work and curtailing the right to strike. Just to give you an example, since 1982, Canada, more complaints have been filed against Canada by its unions than against any other country in the world, at the level of the International Labour Organization, which is sort of the international body that tries to regulate labor in a similar way to what the United Nations does for state actions.
Well, you mentioned unions taking their grievances to organizations like the ILO, the International Labour Organization, or sometimes to the Supreme Court in their provincial or in the countrywide Supreme Court. But how effective can using this legal process be to counter these acts of legislative attack on union bargaining?
Well, that's a really good question, and that's a question that really divides the labor movement in many ways. There are those who feel it's an effective way of responding, that it, in some ways it's the only way to respond, and there are those who feel that it's ineffective and a waste of resources and time. In terms of what happens, when complaints are filed, the ILO, the International Labor Organization, will review the complaint. If they deem that there's merit to it, they'll strike an investigative committee that'll investigate it and then eventually issue a ruling. And that process takes quite a bit of time. And in the end, they pretty much all they can do is issue a ruling that condemns the government if the government did indeed violate one of the conventions that it signed with the ILO. And interestingly, a study that came out a few years ago indicated that it was three-quarters of all the complaints that had been filed against Canadian governments were found by the ILO to indeed be in violation of freedom of association principles. So Canada has been sort of rapped on the knuckles several times by the ILO. But in terms of how effective, eventually the government becomes sort of, I think, normalized, the idea that yes, this is a violation of international conventions we've signed, but since there's no repercussions, it sort of continues doing it. Now the only sort of glimmer that I see to that is that there was a really interesting Supreme Court ruling back in 2007. It was one of the first rulings where the Supreme Court had seemed to rule that unions and workers do have a charter right to collective bargaining, because there's a whole jurisprudence that whereby the Supreme Court in Canada had decided that was not the case. But in 2007, the Supreme Court sort of reversed course and said, yes, that opened the door to recognizing a right to collective bargaining. And one of the rationales that it used, there was four main rationales, but one of them was that Canada has signed these international conventions saying it will respect collective bargaining, that it will respect the right to strike, and that in this day and age, that needs to mean something. So in that sense, I think maybe unions were somewhat exonerated and for all the time and effort they'd put into raising this issue at the international level.
Does that mean then that in terms of law in Canada, that unions are assured, guaranteed the right to strike?
No, certainly not. This is something unions have been struggling at the legal level for decades, and there's a huge body of jurisprudence that has gone against unions that has said that, you know, at the most unions might have, you know, that there is somewhat of a fundamental right to form a union that can be seen as guaranteed as under the, you know, freedom of association clauses. However, what you do with that association, i.e. collective bargaining or striking in the case of unions, that is not guaranteed under the Charter. So that's been the overwhelming precedent. Now, this case in 2007 was, you know, quite a shocker to unions and governments alike, because for the first time the Supreme Court suggested that maybe that all that jurisprudence was no longer going to be to hold sway. And part of it had to do with the really overbearing, over-the-top nature of the government legislation. It was in British Columbia that the provincial government had passed legislation overruling collective collective agreements. And so the over-the-top nature of that particular bit of legislation was part of what contributed to it, but it opened the door. And you know, since then there have been rulings that have sort of countermanded that Supreme Court case, but you know, it was opening a door, and it's still an extremely fraught area of law that's, you know, it's a battle that's being waged by many unions. And I think we'll see that now, particularly with the recent cases of the federal government intervening in labor disputes.
Back to work legislation, it has been exercised in Newfoundland and Labrador. What can you tell us about some of the methods of resistance that workers have used in Newfoundland and Labrador?
Well, there's been quite a resistance to it. The most dramatic was in 1986 when a public sector strike, government legislated the workers back to work, and workers en masse refused. There were mass arrests. And the opposition party, or one of the opposition parties in government, took the side of the unions and went out, joined them on the lines, and they were arrested as well. So these were, you know, elected legislators who were being arrested too. And there was a, you know, a real concern, actually. The Department of Justice expressed concern that they couldn't keep control of the jails if the police kept arresting all of these strikers. So it shows, you know, when faced with a degree of militancy, it shows the limits of the sort of coercive cracking down on the right to strike. Now, more recently, there was an interesting the Vale Inco strike in 2009, which affected workers both in Sudbury, Ontario, as well as Voisey's Bay, Labrador. The Ontario dispute was actually settled before the settlement in Labrador, and so the Newfoundland and Labrador government got involved. It commissioned an investigation. It was sort of their way of exerting muscle on the dispute. It commissioned an investigation to find out why this strike was lingering as long as it was, and the government commission issued a report called the Royal Report, which was it basically highlighted that in today's age, when we have these massive transnational corporations, the traditional industrial legality regime does not work. You know, these are companies that can outsit strikes because they have massive global production chains and massive amounts of wealth. So it's a traditional labor relations doesn't work in that sort of environment, because strikes are not as effective against a large transnational operating at the global scale as they are against a domestic company. So it made a number of recommendations as to how the playing field could be leveled, so to speak, to give unions more of an equal sort of bargaining position.
Very briefly, you talk of a creative tactic called a work in. Just give us an example of what approach that means.
Sure. That was sort of actually Sam Gindin, who's a researcher in Ontario, used to work with the Canadian auto workers. He's the one who really coined sort of the phrase. But the idea is, instead of going out on strike, instead of going leaving the workplace and refusing to do work, for instance, in a garbage strike, for instance, like the one we had in Toronto there a couple years ago, instead workers would sort of go in and take over the workplace and provide service, a better level of service than the way that their managers do. And it sort of highlights that part of, labor struggle and part of what unions are out there to do is not just win more money by refusing to work unless you get more money, but it's about exerting some degree of control over the workplace and over the labor process, taking back that control for workers. So, say if you had a school teachers, who are out on strike, instead of refusing to give service, maybe school teachers could come in, on their time off, or school teachers who don't have work could come in and start providing service and making decisions about how they're going to provide service in the workplace. And the idea is, what would the government or what would the managers do? Would they sort of refuse the extra level of service, or would they let the workers take on that role and provide a better level of service and show to the public that, if we countermand this whole austerity regime, if we actually have adequate levels of work and staffing, and if we let the workers make the decisions about the work process, that we're going to have a lot better services for the country.
Well, thanks for sharing these ideas with us. I really appreciate that.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I've been speaking with Hans Rollman. He's a reporter, columnist, and opinion editor for the Newfoundland and Labrador-based website. The website is called theindependent.ca.